Broadcasting live to New York, Bloomberg 1130. To Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 99.1. To Boston, Bloomberg 1200. To San Francisco, Bloomberg 960. To the country, SiriusXM Channel 119. And around the globe, the Bloomberg Radio Plus app and Bloomberg.com. This is Bloomberg Surveillance.
Good morning, 7:30 on Wall Street. I'm Michael McKee along with Tom Keene. We had some breaking news just a short time ago. Thermo Fisher is going to buy FEI Corporation, $4.2 billion the price. Thermo Fisher, $107.50 a share in cash. FEI makes electron microscopes. Thermo Fisher makes mass spectrometry systems, and experts say the two are complementary. Google won a jury verdict, killing Oracle's claim to a $9 billion slice of the Android phone business. Oracle had contended Google needed a license to use its Java programming language to develop Android. Jury in San Francisco rejected that argument. Apple shares still down 0.6% in early trading this morning. Snapchat, if you don't use it, your kids do. The app sends disappearing messages valued at $18 billion after its latest round of funding. According to a person familiar with the matter, the financing pads the startup's war chest, wants to evolve from a teen phenomenon into a mainstream media platform. We'll see. Now let's check in with Michael Barr and get the latest world and national headlines. Michael?
Mike, thank you very much. President Barack Obama has paid his respects to the 140,000 people killed when the U.S. dropped an atomic bomb on Hiroshima, Japan in 1945.
A memory of the morning of August 6th, 1945 must never fade.
President Obama laid a wreath at Hiroshima Peace Memorial Park today and met with some bombing survivors. A French vessel has arrived in the Mediterranean to help search for the Egypt Air plane that crashed last week with 66 people on board. Meanwhile, the chief investigator in Egypt says search teams have picked up a signal from one of the devices on the plane that transmits its location. It narrows the search down to a 3-mile radius. A Korean Air flight at Tokyo's airport had to be evacuated after an engine fire while on the runway. No one was injured. The Boeing 777 with 318 people on board was heading to Seoul. Global news 24 hours a day, powered by our 2,400 journalists and more than 150 news bureaus around the world. I'm Michael Barr. Mike?
Thank you, Michael. Time now for the Land Rover Parsippany Bloomberg NBC Sports Update with John Stasher.
Thanks, Mike. Steph Curry struggled in Golden State's two lopsided losses at Oklahoma City. People wondered if he was still injured, but the two-time MVP looked fine last night. 31.7 rebounds, 6 assists, 5 steals. Warriors stayed alive, 120-111 to cut the Thunder's lead to 3-2 as they go to OKC for Game 6 tomorrow. Mike D'Antoni, former Knick coach, hired in Houston. The Rangers got a good look at just how well the Pittsburgh Penguins were playing back in round one. Penguins finished the regular season winning 14 of 16. It has carried over. They won Game 7 from Tampa Bay 2-1 as rookie Brian Rust scored twice in the second period. So the Stanley Cup final, Pittsburgh versus San Jose, Game 1 Monday. Yankees tonight begin a 10-game road trip at Tampa Bay. They come off two losses that followed the 6 straight wins. They managed just 3 singles off Jay Happ after a Starlin Castro home run in the first inning. The Blue Jays won 3-1. The Mets host the Dodgers tonight. The Dodgers are starting 19-year-old lefty Julio Urias. He's from Mexico. He's been dominant in the minor leagues. Mets are a game behind Washington, who topped St. Louis 2-1. Bryce Harper with an upper deck home run. With the Bloomberg NBC Sports Update, I'm John Stashower.
Well, it is looking like we're going to open higher this morning. S&P futures up by 2 points, Dow futures by 15. Little change in Europe, though. Everybody waiting for Janet Yellen's speech this afternoon, or her appearance. It's not a speech. It's a discussion with Greg Mankiw of Harvard. We'll see whether it produces anything. This is Bloomberg Surveillance. I'm Michael McKee along with Tom Keene, and we are looking at dollar index that is little changed, slightly higher today. The yen comes in at 109.63, the euro 111.71, the pound 146.62. Tom and I watching that. It's a little weaker today. It is all about Brexit, obviously, until the end of June. Time now for the Bloomberg NJIT STEM report, brought to you by New Jersey Institute of Technology, investing more than $110 million a year in applied research to solve problems and improve life. Learn more at storiesofinnovation.nj. JIT.edu. Here's Bob Moon.
Good morning, Michael. Here's what's making news in science, technology, engineering, and math. More now on that copyright infringement dispute between Oracle and Google over the Android operating system. Oracle says it plans to appeal Google's victory. Still, legal experts say overturning the jury verdict will be difficult, and it may give comfort to programmers who write applications that run across different platforms without a license. While Oracle contended Google should have licensed its use of Java programming language in its Android system, which now runs 80% of the world's mobile devices, Google said it used Java to innovate rather than merely copy code. Jurors in San Francisco federal court rejected the argument of Oracle and concluded that Google did make fair use of the code under copyright law. Microsoft researchers and the National University of Singapore will collaborate on data science, deep learning, artificial intelligence, according to a joint statement. The university's new Institute of Data Science is aimed at nurturing scientists for Singapore's Smart Nation Initiative. Microsoft Chief Satya Nadella attended the signing ceremony in Singapore. And Microsoft and Facebook are teaming up to feed the insatiable demand for bandwidth. The two plan to build a 4,100-mile undersea cable stretching from Virginia to Spain. The cable will deliver faster online and cloud services to customers of both companies. It's to be completed by the fall of 2017. And that is this morning's Bloomberg NJIT STEM Report. Michael.
Thank you very much, Bob Moon. Well, he is a Pulitzer Prize winner. He's an authority on international politics and economics. He's written best-selling books, and the only thing anybody wants to know from Daniel Yergin is, what's it going to cost me to fill up my tank as I drive around the country on this Memorial Day? He's vice chairman of IHS, and he is maybe the world's leading energy expert. Good morning to you, Dan. I won't ask you that question, but I will ask you where we are with oil right now. It's easy to say, does it go up? Does it go down? But really the question is kind of where are we in the balance of supply and demand that will influence prices going forward?
It's so striking to see how different it is from just 3 months ago when oil was around $26. And now, as you know, yesterday it touched $50. So I think it's a signal of the market moving back into balance. It's been accelerated in that direction by outages in Canada, of course, from the giant fires, and then worryingly what's happening in Nigeria, which is production is down because of violence, and the brooding concern about what happens to Venezuela. So all of that's reflected in the price, and as the oil exporters get ready to go to Vienna for their next meeting of OPEC.
Yeah, that seems to probably have lost some of its drama.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, remember in February there was talk about the freeze to try and stabilize the price, but the market itself has stabilized it, helped by these disruptions. So it's not clear what would be the topic at OPEC other than kind of continuing where it is. And really in the third quarter, we'll see a market in balance. And even this summer, we're going to see the combined imports of U.S. and Chinese oil into the U.S. and into China up over 1 million barrels a day compared to last year.
Well, it's interesting you use the word the market has stabilized. How stable is it? We've seen an awful lot of volatility over the last 12 months. What does stable mean in that context?
Well, I think it means that very unlikely to see what we saw earlier this year, which was really the bottom. And, you know, I think in sort of February we had capitulation by many producers as they cut their budgets by 50%, the independent producers. So I think you're quite right. It's going to be volatile. One thing to watch is what the main Gulf producers do in terms of stepping up production. You know, it'll be all those demand things. So it's not going to be, you know, that I don't think it's going to be stable. It's going to be volatile, and people will read signals going in one direction or another. But I think what happened yesterday with $50 was a signal that that we're kind of going to be moving into the recovery phase in terms of global oil.
Well, we've dropped back now, $48.90 at the moment for Brent. Does it breach 50, and how high could it go?
Well, we've been using saying in the second half of the year, we think oil is in a sort of average in a 50-ish range, maybe between 50 and 55, but around, you know, in that neighborhood, and we got there a little earlier because of, you know, the outages that I described before.
Well, the real question then becomes, at what price would frackers come back into the market and upset the balance, the stability?
Yeah, I just was in Houston earlier this week and talked to a lot of them. And, you know, I think that at 50, they start to generate, you know, more cash flow. But I think that companies and their lenders are going to be cautious until they really see some foundation. So there's this notion that, you know, you've got to get closer to 60, or as one CEO told me, you have to have line of sight of 60 to really be stepping things up and to convince people and to convince boards of directors to make any major steps forward.
Let's come back with Daniel Yergin from IHS. Interesting speech yesterday by the Republican nominee for a president on energy in the future. We'll get his thoughts on that coming up here on Bloomberg Surveillance. We're counting down to the opening bell, brought to you by the Jeep Grand Cherokee, the most awarded SUV ever. The Grand Cherokee continues to raise the bar with its luxurious interior and legendary 4x4 capability. Drive one at your local Jeep dealer today.
Global business news 24 hours a day at Bloomberg.com, the Radio Plus mobile app, and on your radio. This is a Bloomberg Business Flash.
And I'm Karen Moscow. Thermo Fisher Scientific will buy FEI for about $4.2 billion, gaining imaging technology for the life sciences and materials sciences industries. Global equities are headed for their highest close in 3 weeks, the dollar's rising against most peers, as investors wait to see whether comments from Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen will disrupt the calm that's settled over financial markets. We check the markets every 15 minutes throughout the trading day on Bloomberg. S&P E-mini futures up 1.5 points, Dow E-mini futures up 14, and NASDAQ E-mini futures are up 7. The DAX in Germany is up 0.1%. 10-year Treasury up 1/32nd. The yield 1.82%. NYMEX crude oil is down 1.1% or 54 cents to $48.94 a barrel. COMEX gold down 0.1% or $1.10 to $12.21.60 an ounce. The euro, $1.1168, the yen, 109.64, and shares of FEI up more than 13% in early trading. And Blackstone Group, the world's biggest private equity property investor, planning to sell hotel buildings in London, Dublin, and Amsterdam for about $1.1 billion. That's according to people with knowledge of the matter. That's a Bloomberg Business Flash. Tom and Mike.
Karen, thanks so much. Bloomberg Surveillance this morning brought to you by Interactive Brokers Investors Marketplace, an online service where traders, investors, and institutions can meet and collaborate, enhance your business trading experience, and expand your business. Visit ibkr.com/services, ibkr.com/services. We are honored to have Daniel Yergin with us today on his quest, his prize, his commanding heights. But what many of you may not know, the book that launched Yergin's career was Shattered Peace. It redefined how we study diplomacy, and particularly that between the United States and Russia. Dr. Yergin, today was a day of remarkable moment at Hiroshima. And so much of it to me is two nations listening to each other, which was part of the heart of your Shattered Peace. From where you sit and with your years of experience, are the Japanese listening to the president? Are the Japanese listening to the United States?
I think that the visit to Hiroshima clearly had a very big and significant impact to the Japanese people and connected. I think that the Japanese have gotten, if anything, they are more concerned recently about the relationship with the U.S. There's the economic, but really the strategic, because of this kind of polarization that's going on in East Asia and the controversy over China's stance in the South China Sea, which is the highway for two-fifths mm-hmm. of world trade.
Interesting. And, of course, you discussed that at length in the prize and the quest in your work decades ago on the need for hydrocarbons of Japan. Mike, maybe that discourse in the moment in Hiroshima brings us back to what you observed yesterday in the Dakotas in our present presidential campaign.
Well, Donald Trump went to North Dakota to give a speech on what his energy policy would be. One of the things he suggested is that we just start drilling more and more And I'm wondering, it struck me as immediately as kind of odd, given the fact that the economy took a big hit from the over supply that we generated. And I wonder if that's a good idea, Dan, and how that would play out.
Yeah, it's as you say, the world oil market has been transformed by what's happened in the United States. You know, as we talked before, OPEC is meeting, but when you think about it, there's something we can call the big three of world oil, and two of them aren't in OPEC. One is Russia, and the other is, in fact, the United States. Well, I think that Mr. Trump had an audience that welcomed his remarks in North Dakota, because, of course, North Dakota was a state that boomed, had the lowest unemployment rate from the development of the Bakken Shale. And I think his words fell on very welcoming ears, just the general notion of getting production going again. But, of course, it's going to be the global price that's going to do that. It's not going to be words that will do it. It will respond to the market.
Well, he said we should have energy independence, complete American energy independence. He said totally independent of the need to import energy from the oil cartel or any nation hostile to our interest. Does that work? Is that what we want?
Well, I think that first, if you look at all energy, we're largely self-sufficient. In fact, we're oversupplied if you look at gas. So we're really just talking about oil. And our oil imports have gone down from about 60% of our total supply to, well, they're going to be up now somewhat, but, you know, around 25 to 30%. So we're in a much more resilient position. But at the end of the day, there is still only one global oil market. And, you know, the price goes up because of outages in Nigeria, and whether we're importing oil from Nigeria or not, we're going to be reflected here. But energy independence has been a thing that presidents and presidential candidates have been calling for since the 1973 oil embargo, what President Nixon had. And for years and years and years, it looked like we were only going to import more oil.
Right.
With shale turned around. And it certainly has made our position different. And I'll tell you, when I travel elsewhere in the world, there is a much greater sense that there's geopolitical consequences, that the U.S. is in a better position and more influential position because of what's happened with our domestic energy.
Okay, but within that goes to Mike's original question. The nirvana of energy independence means we don't have a relationship with strategic and tactical partners. We want to maintain those relationships, which means we want a bilateral agreement on energy, don't we? We want them to participate.
I mean, I've become convinced over time that the best way to actually let these things work is actually let the market work, and that it was, after all, the market and innovation that provided this revolution in U.S. energy. But it was true in Mr. Trump's remarks, and he also called for the Keystone Pipeline to be built, and of course our major source of imported oil is in fact Canada. So, you know, I sometimes think that this term energy independence is kind of really a metaphor, but our position as a country overall is a lot better than it was even 6 or 7 years ago in terms of energy.
The Republican candidate also suggests that through some magic of his incredible abilities, he'll be able to bring back coal mining jobs and bring back coal as a major supplier of energy. Is that likely to happen?
Well, I think coal is down for two reasons. One is, of course, it is harder to, well, it's very hard, basically impossible to build a new coal-fired plant, and the pressure on existing plants is increasing. But the other issue out there is inexpensive natural gas, and gas has now overtaken coal as for our electric generation. You know, it's interesting that as a country, we made a huge bet on coal in the 1980s for electric generation because it was inexpensive and because it was domestic and it was secure. And now that position is really eroded. So there's going to be growth in coal consumption globally, but not in the United States.
Dan, do your economists and your financial types at IHS, do they believe the balance sheets have been cleared? Or are we setting ourselves up for a summer, you know, I guess end of September 30, third quarter into November, of further carnage on balance sheets of oil companies?
Well, that's, you know, there's a combination. A, there's a carnage, and B, there's what the regulators decide to do. And I think if we're looking at $50 oil, that takes a lot of the pressure off companies that they were, you know, at 30 or 40. I think the debt problems, and that's still going to be one of the drags in terms of, you know, kind of turning things around. And I don't think we're going to see any increase in that kind of activity where we were adding 1 million barrels a day for 3 years in a row, more or less. But I think, you know, so I still think the debt is there. And, of course, the shale industry was a big beneficiary of very low interest rates in terms of access access to capital.
Let me quickly ask you, because we just have a minute left here. So where does that leave the U.S. in this whole question of energy independence and our own supplies? Is this going to last even with the price at a level where we're not drilling constantly?
Yeah. Well, I think that we're seeing U.S. production go down. The high point was April of last year, and we'll probably be down well over 1 million barrels a day before things balance out, maybe 1.2 million barrels a day. So, in fact, I think we're going to see our imports go up modestly. You know, Americans, we're coming up to Memorial Day. Americans are driving more than ever before. Gasoline prices are still cheap, so demand is going up, and domestic supply is down somewhat. And that means, in fact, that we'll be importing somewhat more oil than we were this time last year. So energy independence, I think, should be maybe seen as a rhetorical aspiration rather than reflecting the, you know, the real flows of supply and demand.
Dr. Juergen, thank you so much. Daniel Juergen with IHS, of course, perspective from his commanding. It's great to speak to him on this most historic day for our Pacific policy. Futures up 2, Dow futures up 15. 10-year yield, a churn, a little bit in this morning, 1.82%. I would note German yields. I haven't talked about them this morning, but German 2-year, negative 0.523. And the 10-year with a little bit of weight, 0.13%, positive 0.13% moving this morning. This is Bloomberg Surveillance.